Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Sally Rush Wagner. Wagner is the founder of one of the country's first women's studies programs at California State University, Sacramento, in 1970, and is also one of the first women to receive a doctorate for work in women's studies in the U.S. at UC Santa Cruz in 1978. She's the nation's foremost authority on a little-known 19th-century suffragette named Matilda Jocelyn Gage, and is the executive director of the Gage Foundation in Fayetteville, New York. Welcome to the show, Sally.
Thank you, Tish. I'm delighted to be here.
Now, when did you develop an interest in women's history?
May I do a confession?
Yes.
I grew up hating history. I grew up with the great men, great wars, great dates approach to history. No context, no stories, no human life form visible. And it wasn't until I fell in love with a dead woman that I became, one might say, a born-again historian. What happened was that I, as you said, helped found one of the first women's studies programs in the country, was teaching in the program, and I would invite my students to listen to a guest lecturer who would tell them all about the women's rights movement. And I never let them know that I really didn't care about these women who had spent 72 years on their knees asking for the right to vote. That was the story that we had at that time.
Absolutely.
In the early, late 60s, early 70s, about what the women's rights movement was. Had nothing to do with what we were doing as radical feminists on the street.
Uh-huh.
Intending to overthrow patriarchy in 6 months.
I remember the days. I was younger then. But
oh, the energy of those days. So a friend of mine came over and said she was doing research on a very important women's suffrage campaign that took place in South Dakota in 1890. She said, did you ever run across the name Matilda Gage related to your hometown, Aberdeen? She knew I grew up in Aberdeen. And I said, well, my mother had a close friend named Matilda. And she was pretty old when I was growing up, but I don't think she was that old.
Yeah.
So I called my mom and said, what's the deal here? And she said, oh, that was Matilda's grandmother.
Wow.
And she was a very important suffragist. And don't you remember when Matilda and I dressed up and did a play, a skit for the Dakota Territorial Pioneers, and I played Susan B. Anthony and Matilda played her grandmother? Well, I didn't remember that. I was a little kid. So I said, well, let me, I'd really love to visit with Matilda. In truth, I wanted one good anecdote. I wanted a story that I could come in and tell my class before I turned it over to somebody who would tell them about women's history. Well, I walked into Matilda's house the next time I went back that summer to South Dakota to visit. And I walked into, instead of one anecdote, the rest of my life.
That's amazing.
It was in the summer of 1973. And when I came there that summer, we'd gone through a really painful split in the women's studies program in Sacramento. We had questions about whether to make it public, whether to keep it private, what would
you
do?
I was going to ask you that. What was the original philosophy around women's studies in those early days? What was the focus going to be?
It really was not just that we were going to bring women into the different disciplines. That was the sort of short-range plan. But the long-range plan was that we would change the paradigm of knowledge.
Mm.
And I think in that there has been some amazing success. We understand the creation of knowledge now in the academy in very different ways. Well, anyway, Matilda Jewel Gage was the namesake, the granddaughter, had her dining room table piled with her grandmother's papers.
Wow.
She had published manuscripts, unpublished manuscripts, correspondence, one of the first letters I picked up, Matilda Jocelyn Gage writing to her son, the Matilda that I was in the room with, her father. Matilda Jocelyn Gage had written to Thomas Clarkson Gage, Mrs. Stanton is the Benedict Arnold of the movement, but she is nothing compared to Susan B., who has destroyed our movement. Now, if I would have looked at that letter as a trained historian, I think I would have said, well, this is a malcontent. This
Absolutely,
is somebody who...
Yeah.
But I looked at the letter and her with the eyes of a feminist, and I said, I'm going to find the truth of what this woman is saying. And then I found very clear evidence that they had gone through a split, and I learned from this foremother 100 years before how to handle the split that we were going through. And at that moment, I was hooked.
Now, why do you think Matilda Gage was left out of history, pretty much?
Well,
people have not heard of her.
No, that letter tells it all. At first I thought, well, she probably wasn't that important, because if she would have been that important, we would know about her. Then I find the Woman's Tribune in 1888 saying that these three names, Stanton, Anthony, and Gage, will ever hold a grateful place in the hearts of posterity, the triumvirate of the National Woman Suffrage Association. And then I started looking through all of the officer positions, and she is in there running the movement as the chair of the executive committee for most of the 20 years of its existence. She's co-authoring all the important documents with Stanton, and she's co-presenting them with Anthony. It's this sort of amazing person who is both Stanton, the theoretician who was no activist at all, hated to go to meetings, and Anthony, who was all activism and no theory. She's both. So how could we have forgotten about her?
How could we have forgotten
about her? How could we not know about her? The unlayering of that comes through that original letter. In 1890, Susan B. Anthony, who always had a vision just of the vote, if truth be told, she had a somewhat pedestrian mind. She really didn't have a vision of much more than, let's just do what's ahead of us. Mm-hmm. And it's a perfectly respectable thing to say.
It was quite a lot of work.
United
just doing
Front,
that
let's just
in your
work
life.
On the vote. Mm-hmm. Stanton and Gage said, you know what, the vote isn't even half a loaf. It's a crumb. It's simply a tool that women will use to fight against all the different oppressions. But the real issue are all those different issues that we have to fight with in terms of the church, the family, the capitalists, and the state. Mm-hmm. They named those four areas. But Anthony said, no, what we'll do is we'll bring everybody together in a united front, get everybody working on the vote, and then we'll sort out the issues later.
Uh-huh.
Well, that would have worked maybe and been a decent thing to do, except that Anthony began courting Frances Willard, who was the president of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, 250,000 strong, compared to about 25,000 in the women's suffrage movement, the National Women's Suffrage Association. So she brings in Willard, but Willard is part of this religious right coalition of fundamentalists who are under the rubric of the Prohibition Party, trying to get God in the Constitution and create a theocracy. Jesus Christ is the head of the government. You will not vote if you do not declare allegiance to Jesus Christ.
Isn't that an amazing parallel to happening now?
Oh, they came within one vote in the Senate of getting it in 1889.
And so Gage was fighting against this.
Gage said,
absolutely,
you know what?
Right?
If we lose religious freedom in this country, it's not going to matter who votes. This is the great danger of the hour. Susan B. Anthony effected a merger between the conservative and the more radical organizations of the women's suffrage movement. Gage tried to undo it, was unsuccessful, and she dropped out of the movement and out of view at that point.
So she dropped out, she was not kicked out. I was assuming that she became unpopular among her peers.
She went on to form her own organization, the Women's National Liberal Union. The function of it was to fight religious fundamentalism, 1890. Not that this has any bearing on anything going on today. Gloria Steinem said about Matilda Joslyn Gage, this is the woman who was ahead of the women who were ahead of their time. Mm-hmm. And that really is today. Her writings, her ideas are so on the edge. She wrote in 1893, for example, about trafficking in women. We're now developing a program, an interpretive program at the House. She offered her home as a station on the Underground Railroad, and our Underground Railroad programming is going to talk about slavery in the United States today and human trafficking. And we will use writings of Matilda Joslyn Gage from 1893.
Now, you're the foremost authority on her. If you hadn't come along, would she be in our horizon
well,
at this moment in time?
That's an interesting question. I never really thought about that. I would like to think that somebody else might have come along, but Matilda Jewel Gage had all of her grandmother's papers, and she was just desperate. She was in her late 80s at the time that I went there for the visit. She was desperate, didn't know what to do with them.
Good heavens.
Maybe they would have been dumped. No children, no heirs.
So nobody who was doing research about the suffragists movement and came upon papers of Susan B. Anthony and so on, she wasn't mentioned in any of their papers?
Well, when Susan B. Anthony and her handpicked biographer sat down together to write Susan B. Anthony's biography, when they finished it, they burned every single letter. It took Susan B. Anthony's sister Mary a month to burn the correspondence. And it wasn't just all the letters that Anthony had. It was all the letters that she had asked people to send to her when she was writing her biography.
My goodness.
And Elizabeth Cady Stanton culled her papers, and then her children, two of her children, culled them even further, wanting her to be remembered in a certain way. So in their collections, there's only a handful of Matilda Jocelyn Gage correspondence that exists.
Oh, that's amazing the way history gets sabotaged.
Isn't it?
Oh, my God. Now, let's talk a little bit about you. You do theatrical performances of historical women. How do you get into these mindsets to play these parts? Tell us who you've played. You've played Matilda, right?
I do. I portrayed Matilda, but I hardly do that anymore because I was wearing too many hats. I mean, I'm the foremost scholar. I'm the director of the Gage Foundation. I write about Matilda. It just was too much. So I've retired that character pretty much, and ironically, I perform as Elizabeth Cady Stanton. I look more like Stanton. And here's a little confession time as well. I think it must have been about 88, I was asked to portray Stanton for the Great Plains Chautauqua. It's a humanities program, public humanities, and scholars dress up and portray these historic characters in communities throughout the Midwest. It's actually a program that goes on around the country, not in the state of New York, but a number of other places. And I said, when they asked me, I can't do that. I'm Matilda Jocelyn Gage. Then I thought about it, and I thought about, it was Virginia Woolf who said, biography is enriched by hanging mirrors at odd angles. And I thought about the psychological principle of, if you have one light in a dark room, you have no idea where that light is. It moves all over the room. It's only the second light that positions the first in the dark room. And I thought, this is an odd angle. This is that second light. I will develop Stanton as a character. And I've got to tell you the truth. Stanton is a much more fun character than Matilda. Matilda would have been so difficult to be friends with because she is the most principled person I know, living or dead.
So a little bit.
She is relentless in her. Not only does she not suffer fools gladly, she will not begin to understand how someone could not live on the edge of courage.
So she didn't have much of a sense of humor, is that
she
is
did.
That
she had fun as well. But I think that she's that sort of friend that mirrors for you the places in you where you wish you were a better person. Stanton sits back and, you know, has another dish of ice cream and just laughs. And she actually had much better lines than Matilda.
Well, how did you develop her voice and so on? Do we have recordings of her voice?
Not of Stanton's voice. Mm. Matilda's was very light. It was very low. I actually, when I perform as those two characters, I psychologically prepare myself in very different ways. With Gage, I sit on the edge of the chair before I go out. And all of this is unscripted. It's 30 years of research that comes together in that moment. I have no idea when I go out on stage what I'll say first.
Really?
I have a script in my head that I've developed based on the situation that I'm in. They're never the same. I've never done two performances the same in 20 years of doing this.
It's improv.
And
inside
I didn't
of
know
a circle
that's what
of,
it was.
Of knowledge.
I started doing this as a research tool when I was writing my dissertation on Gage. I went into my class, put on the costume my mother wore when she played Susan B. Anthony. How's that for coming full circle? And And I said, what would you like to know about Gage? And I thought it would be a way to keep myself centered on the larger picture when I was really getting caught up in the minutiae when I was writing my dissertation. And it was very effective as a research tool. And then people liked it, and they asked if I would do it somewhere else. And I started doing it, and pretty soon I was doing it nationally. And I resigned a tenure-track teaching position to do it almost full-time.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sally Rush Wagner. She's the executive director of the Matilda Jocelyn Gage Center, I suppose?
You know,
Historical Center?
Well, you must be a seer, because we actually now are called the Foundation, but we're in the process of chartering the museum under New York State law. Every museum has to. We have to change our name, and we are going to be the Matilda Jocelyn Gage Center.
My goodness.
So you said it for the first time on the air publicly.
Now, I want to talk to you about the groundbreaking book that you wrote called The Untold Story of the Iroquois, Influence on the Early Feminists.
Yes.
Talk to us about their influence.
Well, this is a story. I just have to be very honest with you. If someone had come to me, a graduate student, saying, as a dissertation topic, I'd like to explore this, I would have said to them 20 years ago, you know, I doubt if there's really a connection. It's such a far shot. I mean, do you have some evidence for this? Because I'm sure that if there had been, someone would have found it by now, and someone would have written it by now.
I'm glad you didn't say that about Gage.
Well, you point out a contradiction there. Some of us learn slowly. This is information that I was brought kicking and dragging into. Mm-hmm. I got a National Endowment for the Humanities Fellowship to study Gage. And the question that I had was, how did she get her transformational vision? As an early feminist in the second wave, I knew that if you didn't have a sense that it was possible, you didn't have anything to hang on to. Mm. When the hegemony is so absolute and the world is so structured against the possibility of freedom, you can't envision it. So where was the pinpoint? Where was the light? Where was the tiny crack that allowed her to see the possibility of something better? Because she went straight from the oppression of 19th century women, which was, you know, it was beyond not having rights. They had no legal existence. Husbands could will away children. Mm. You know, they could beat their wives, had the absolute religious and legal authority to do so. It just, you know, goes on and on. How did she get from that place of oppression to seeing not equality, but transformation and balance? She had to have seen something. That was my question. If truth be told further, Matilda Jocelyn Gage gave me the answer in the first 10 pages of her major work, Woman, Church, and State. But if you don't have eyes to see something, it can be right there in front of you. And I realized when I got pretty honest with myself that I had a lot of stereotypes about Native women. Mm. They were beasts of burden. What did they have to teach white women? You know, racism is probably the worst enemy of scholarship. That and sexism, it keeps you from seeing what's there. Matilda Jocelyn Gage in Woman, Church, and State, first chapter, first 10 pages, says, never was justice more perfect. Never was civilization higher. Now, should that be a clue that maybe that's what she saw? Well, I was 17 years into my research before I saw what she was pointing out to me. And I started looking from her sources first, and then worked just with primary sources, looking for what was the position of Haudenosaunee or Iroquois women. Mm-hmm. What was their contact with white women? Could there have been any?
Yeah, I would.
And what I
that.
Found was that every single woman in the suffrage movement in New York State during that time that was important was not one person removed from Haudenosaunee connection. They had Haudenosaunee connection.
And how did this connection take place?
The system that we understand now of separation, the apartheid, if you will, that goes on in the country today, was not existent during that early settlement period. Matilda Jocelyn Gage was adopted into the Wolf Clan of the Mohawk Nation. She was given a real name. Elizabeth Cady Stanton's nearest neighbor in Seneca Falls was fluent Onondaga speaker who had been adopted into one of the clans at Onondaga when he lived there. So she has, her nearest neighbor talks Indian. And if she goes over there to visit, who's she going to find? The newspapers are full of his relatives coming from Onondaga and staying with him.
That's amazing.
His adopted relatives. Lucretia Mott, when she comes to visit her friends in Waterloo, and together, when Elizabeth Cady Stanton comes from Seneca Falls to visit, they plan that first women's rights convention in 1848. Lucretia Mott's coming from Cattaraugus, from the Seneca Reservation, where she has observed women with a political voice, women planning the spiritual ceremony. At a time when, except for the Quakers, just women getting up and speaking, women were not allowed to speak in the churches in any of the denominations. Mm. And she's watching a whole different world. She's part of a whole different world. Now, I think that may have been part of the energy that she brought into that. You and I, Tish, let's say that you've been someplace and you've seen something absolutely remarkable that you didn't know human beings were capable of.
Mm-hmm.
And you sit down and Elizabeth Cady Stanton opens her mouth and says, "I am just distraught." She said she poured forth her discontent with being a housewife, isolated, trying to raise these kids. They're sick. She can't read a book through. She hasn't had a thought of her own. What she thought was going to be ideal, she was going to be the perfect wife and mother. And the institutional of it precludes that possibility.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And she pours out that discontent. Now, if you're Lucretia Mott, having come from a world in which women have a status, children come through the female line, they are native because their mothers are.
Mm-hmm.
They're in the clan of their mothers. The women are considered twice as important as the men. There's a balance and a harmony. The clan mothers are choosing, the chiefs are nominating them, they're putting them in place. The men listen to the women. You come from that world and your friends start speaking the discontent from the world you live in. Is it possible that you might share something from what you've just seen? It's speculative, but
amazing.
The connection is absolutely real and the writing is absolutely real. Elizabeth Cady Stanton says, for example, about birthing, which was a major issue for her. Why is it that only Christian women suffer in childbirth? Native women give birth and they are up and about almost immediately. That led her to being called, she said, a savage when she was up and about, right after she gave birth to her first daughter. And she said, we've got to examine what the differences are in our lifestyles. She said, it's not because we're condemned by God through the sin of Eve. It's because we don't have exercise. We don't have good nutrition. We got to live like Indians.
That's quite a tale, is it not?
They knew about property rights. At the International Council of Women in 1888, Alice Fletcher, who's an ethnographer and a suffragist, stands up. She starts her talk with this story. She says, I was sitting with a group of Native women. It was Omaha women. She worked with the Plains. She said, one of the women gave away a horse, and without thinking about it, I asked her, aren't you going to ask your husband first? She said, the merriment with which my statement was met. This woman goes over to her friends, and you know what's happening. She goes over to her friends and says, you know what this crazy white woman just asked me? She just asked me why I didn't ask my husband before I gave away a horse. It's sort of like she said, I have forgotten for 1 minute that I was with Indian women.
That's
the difference. It was apparent to these women. She goes on then to say, I've talked to a lot of Native people and men as well, and they tell me that they're really concerned that what's going to happen with this forced civilization, the process of Christianization and civilization,
mm-hmm.
that was the governmental policy in the 1880s when they divided up the reservations and gave them like spoils of war to different churches to Christianize and civilize, took the kids out of the home and sent them to boarding school and just absolutely did devastating destruction. But it's in that moment, she said, what I'm hearing from Indian men is that they're worried about what's going to happen to them with this process, but they're more worried about what's going to happen to the women because they're going to lose their status as Indians, but they're going to be treated as badly as white women.
Oh.
And she gives this example of, she says, if a husband mistreats his wife, her brothers and father, the men of her clan, will take care of him. You know, he is not going to do that again. Under white law, the perpetrator is not going to get punished. Who's going to go to jail? The father and the brothers. And she said, that's what they're worried about. The writing was on the wall. Everybody saw it that was involved in the movement, because everybody that was anybody in the women's rights movement was at that International Council of Women in 1888.
And so it's not a secret. We're still trying to live up to those ideals, are we not?
Mm-hmm.
Now, tell us a little bit about what the Gage Foundation or Center or whatever it's going to be called now. What does it exactly do?
Well, we have five areas of interpretation. We have drawn them together under conscience in community. And the story we tell is the story of the creation of democracy and freedom.
Ah.
Through Matilda Jocelyn Gage as the vehicle. She offered the home as a station on the Underground Railroad. We're the only Underground Railroad home open to the public in Onondaga County, one of 23 in the state of New York. Mm. We're listed both federally and state. And that's where we'll be telling the story of slavery today and the courage that it took for freedom seekers, especially, but the people that gave sanctuary to freedom seekers as well. She was pregnant when the Fugitive Slave Act was passed. Mm. It said it was 6 months in prison and $1,000 fine if you helped a fugitive slave escape.
Wow.
If you gave sanctuary to him. $1,000 is about $28,000 by today's money. She's pregnant. She has two little kids. She not only offers her home when the head of the Underground Railroad in Syracuse comes to ask her if she will, she does it publicly. She signs a petition saying to the government, come and get me. You know, what courage.
What a brave
woman.
What
courage. So we tell that story. We tell the women's rights story. We tell the story of religious freedom that she fought. We tell the story of the Haudenosaunee influence on women's rights, and the final story is that she's the mother of Oz. Her son-in-law was L. Frank Baum, who
really?
Was sort of I won't say a ne'er-do-well, but this is a guy who didn't work well in the real world, should we say, had gone bankrupt a couple times until he finally listened to his mother-in-law, and he wrote down the wonderful stories that he told. She said, Frank, write down those stories. There's a market for them. 2 years after her death, he published The Wonderful Wizard of Oz.
Mm.
And if you read the 14 Oz books that he wrote, they are visions of peace and social justice.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
They are the vision of his mother-in-law. Baum scholars today are convinced that she was the intellectual mentor that led him in that direction. So
isn't that a fascinating connection? We call her the mother of Oz.
So what home has five stories to tell? We'll have our major rooms in the house will each be dedicated to one of these themes.
Mm-hmm.
We're in the process now, the quiet phase of a capital campaign. We'll be raising money to rehabilitate the house soon. And when the house opens, we will be telling these stories.
And how can people get in touch with the house and you?
Well, MatildaJocelynGage.com is the website. And it's spelled MatildaJocelynGage.com. Our phone number is 315-637-9511. And we are open for rehabilitation tours, and we really invite people to come and see the bare walls of the house right now.
That's great. Sally Rush Wagner, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tish. I really enjoyed it.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes in Corning, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.